Republican National Committee. They should be ashamed of themselves for allowing this kind of crap to happen.
Some who feed off of the fears and the anger that is felt by some of us and exploit it, feed their own insatiable desires for fame or attention. That could drive America down into a ditch and not make us great again.
If talking about equal pay and paid leave and more opportunities for women and girls is playing the gender card, then deal me in.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09 on this Wednesday, April 13th, 2016. Welcome to another business day. Glad to have you along. We'll start, first of all, with our overnight market intel from the WGN Market Desk this morning. Lots to cover today. Asian stocks logged some solid gains, cheered on by a rally on Wall Street yesterday, although oil prices erased some of the recent big gains that had relieved some of those global investors, so the nervousness may be coming back. Japan's benchmark Nikkei added about 2.5% overnight to finish at 16,381. The rest of the markets around the world generally higher overnight. The economy day ahead, the economic reports are all about business conditions today, so impact on the markets could be big. Data on prices, sales, and inventories coming. The Labor Department releases its producer price index for March later this morning. At the same time, the Commerce Department will release retail sales data for March. And a little later, the Commerce Department releases its report on business inventories for February. This afternoon, the Beige Book comes out by the Federal Reserve. So a lot could move the markets today. We'll see how it goes. There is a lot of news to talk about this morning. Where to begin? Probably with one of the biggest stories affecting a lot of us, our taxes. Yesterday, the head of the IRS testified before Congress that tax thieves are increasingly sophisticated. They're stealing your tax data, my tax data, everybody's tax data to get fraudulent refunds. Here's the IRS Commissioner John Koscherkin.
These systems withstand more than 1 million malicious attempts to access them each day. We're also continuing to battle the growing problem of stolen identity refund fraud. Over the past few years, we've made steady progress in protecting against fraudulent refund claims and criminally prosecuting those who engage in this crime. But we have found the type of criminal we are dealing with has changed. The problem used to be random individuals filing a few dozen or a few hundred false tax returns at a time. Now we're dealing more and more with organized crime syndicates here and in other countries.
In May, you may remember of last year, the IRS said criminals used the agency's online Get Transcript system to obtain information, file fraudulent returns, access as much as 390,000 taxpayer files and personal information. Also this morning, Facebook, the big Facebook developer conference is in full swing, or was at least yesterday, and a lot of things announced by Facebook chairman Mark Zuckerberg. It's going to be a big year for video on Facebook and something about chatbots.
We think that you should just be able to message a business in the same way you'd message a friend. You should get a quick response, and it shouldn't take your full attention like a phone call would. And you shouldn't have to install a new app. Or into your credit card again, you just send a message. I love this one. I find it pretty ironic, because now, to order from 1-800-Flowers, you never have to call 1-800-Flowers again.
Zuckerberg kicked off a 30-minute keynote speech yesterday laying out the company's 10-year plan, which included improvements in artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and augmented reality. And speaking of science, yesterday, did you see this? Billionaire internet investor Yuri Milner was on stage with Stephen Hawking. They announced a $100 million initiative to better understand the cosmos by deploying thousands of tiny spacecraft to travel to our nearest neighboring star system and send back pictures.
This is the Starship, a gram-scale wafer containing cameras, photon thrusters, power supply, and navigation and communication equipment. It's about the size of a large postage stamp.
Stephen Hawking says it's about time we started exploring the universe and the galaxy.
The limit that confronts us now is the great void between us and the stars. But now we can transcend it with light beams, light sails, and the lightest spacecraft ever built. We can launch a mission to Alpha Centauri within a generation. Today, we commit to this next great leap into the cosmos.
Remember this word. It is our word of the day, nanocraft. There are small little boxes that may just fly to our nearest neighbor, Alpha Centauri. Also this week, a number of colleges and universities. Yesterday we spoke with Indiana University, but other universities have been in Chicago, and they have been pitching ideas to venture capitalists and angel investors and showing off what's new in healthcare technology. And Matter, the healthcare community hub and entrepreneurial incubator in Chicago, is at the center of all of this. We're happy to have Miriam Saleh with us this morning. Miriam, welcome to the opening bell.
Thank you.
You have, how many schools did you have in? We're going to just briefly hit this now and then get into the full conversation after traffic, but you had quite a few schools, and they brought in some really good ideas.
Yes, we had about 11 schools. So, I have the list over here, but three in the Chicago region, and the rest of them were outside of the city.
And after they presented, do they walk home with checks? Do they all walk home with checks?
it's more about getting the conversation going. So before, there are things like business plan competitions where we literally walk away with a very small check. It doesn't take you very far usually. But to get those nice big investments that you need to really develop your business, you need to have a longer sort of relationship with investors. And this event was more about setting up that relationship, setting up an opportunity for the researchers and the entrepreneurs to connect with investors that may not come by their universities that often.
If you'd like, during the break, while we check traffic, if you're playing the home game of the opening bell, MatterChicago.com and at MatterChicago on Twitter. We're going to continue our conversation.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
It's 521. Welcome back. We're having a conversation this morning with Miriam Saleh of Matter Chicago, the healthcare community hub and entrepreneurial incubator here in Chicago. Number of universities in to pitch ideas and to get conversations going on new technology. Miriam, before the break, we were sort of teasing some of the schools that were here. Who were the among some of the best, and what are some of the big ideas that you saw?
Sure. I have a hard time saying one university was better than the other, but I'll certainly kind of give you a feel for what technologies were showcased. So in terms of the participating universities, we had the usual suspects, so University of Chicago, Northwestern, University of Illinois, so lots of representation from local universities. And then we sort of reached out to other universities that are a little bit further away. So in Wisconsin, we had WARF, which is associated with the University of Wisconsin, but WARF stands for the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. We had Ohio State, we had Notre Dame. We had Indiana University, as you know, since you spoke to them yesterday, University of Kansas, Medical College of Wisconsin, Rush University. And then we had an accelerator that also participated called BioSTL that sort of focuses on therapeutics. So in terms of what technologies were showcased, while there's quite a wide range, the idea behind this event was to focus sort of more complex technologies in the healthcare space. So Matter's been around for about a year and a half, and in that time we've recruited about 120 startup companies in the healthcare space. The majority of those startups are what we call digital health technologies, and by that I mean they're sort of software solutions that can improve health outcomes or improve efficiencies in hospitals, things of that sort, and I'm happy to give you some examples. However, the goal of this event was really to attract sort of researchers and entrepreneurs who are developing drugs or medical devices and diagnostics, types of technologies that have a longer path to market and can incubate in universities for a longer period of time. So these digital health technologies that I mentioned, have a shorter path to market for obvious reasons. So they don't involve sort of developing a tangible product. And oftentimes the regulatory burdens attached with to those products are not as high as they are for getting a drug approved or getting a medical device approved. However, there's still a need for drugs and medical devices, and what we're finding in the market right now is that the majority of those technologies are being incubated in universities, at least in the Midwest. So this is an opportunity to really reach out to the universities and have them showcase those kinds of technologies. That said, there were a few sort of software technologies that were featured at the event as well. So maybe I'll give you one example of a digital health technology so you can get an understanding of what that means, and then I'll talk about one of the medical device technologies that were featured as well.
Yeah, give us one of those, because we only have about 3 minutes left, but I do want to get a sense of where, you know, what the best is in what you saw there. So let's start with the digital.
Yeah, so the digital. So you know, like I said, I can't really comment on best or worst, but I'll give you the example. So there's a company at the University of Chicago called Prescript IQ. And this is a pretty hot topic in healthcare right now. So it's this idea of personalized medicine. So patients take a large number of, you know, some of, if you're in the later stages of your retirement on Earth, you probably take a lot of drugs, and the diagnosis that your sort of physician does to understand kind of what drugs you take is imperfect. And there's a lot of thought, there are a lot of people out there who are saying that, you know, if you use sort of genetics, so if you do some kind of genetic testing, you're more likely to find sort of the appropriate drug, for your particular condition. So there is a company that's based out of the University of Chicago called Prescript IQ that is using a patient's genetics to identify the safest and most effective medications for patients in real time. So a lot of people are doing this, but Prescript IQ seems to have a solution that works, and they're actually about to head to a very large health system to do a pilot with their product, which we've already tested with a large number of patients at the University of Chicago. So that's an example of a software technology, because they take they're basically able to use sort of a decision-making algorithm to help the physician decide what drugs will be most effective in a patient by looking at sort of the results of a genetic test.
In the minute we have left, Miriam, I'd like to get just your input on the future of all of this and where it's going. Are we going to be more reliant on technology than we are a physical doctor in the future, or will there always be that physician guiding us?
Personally, I believe so. It'll be a hybrid. The body is very complex, and as we're getting older, our diseases are also more complex. And I really don't believe that one person has the ability to integrate all of that information. So why not get some support from computers who can crunch through a lot of data and support our physicians in making their diagnosis? So I believe decision making will be shared between a technology and a physician.
Miriam Salah is the Vice President of Programming at Matter Chicago. You can find them at matterchicago.com and at Matter Chicago on Twitter. Miriam, I'm a little jealous. I wish I could have sat in on a lot of this. I know it was private, but what an exciting time for technology and healthcare.
It was fun.
All right. Thanks for being with us on the opening bell today.
No problem.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:38. Welcome back to the program. I bet you have a ticket, an airline ticket in your pocket or at home somewhere waiting, a big trip planned this summer. I bet you're all excited about it. Don't get too excited. We've been talking on this program a lot about how crowded airlines, the flights are, how little the seats are, how much less room there is, how much fees are being added. But you know what? Those problems are going to be nothing compared to the issues you're going to face before you even get on the plane. American Airlines has been monitoring TSA wait times at airports over the last couple of months. This is not even the summer high season yet. 30 to 60 minutes typical at most airports, 90 minutes at some airports. And they're telling travelers to arrive for domestic flights at least 2 hours before departure just to be safe. Let's bring in Rick Cini. He's the founder and CEO of FareCompare.com in Dallas. Rick with us this morning. Rick, how bad is it going to be?
Well, it's going to be a very, very slow go at the airports this summer. There's a couple of backdrop things that are happening. We have 700 million passengers planned to fly this year. That's up from 638 million last year. At the same time, they expected almost 25 million people to be signed up for PreCheck, only about 9 million signed up. So they actually let go about 10% of screeners. So no screeners at the airports for the summertime crush periods, a lot more passengers. That means they're recommending, and this is one of those ones where they recommend you really, really get there early this summer, or 2 hours early this summer if you're at peak times at the airport.
They're not joking either. American Airlines apparently has been monitoring TSA wait times, and they've found something pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, no, it's taking unbelievably long times to get through. And really, airlines want to push this through. In fact, historically, airports in some cases have wanted to have their own security mechanism. Some of them have been grandfathered in for historically, but this has been crazy long times in some cases, and they think it's actually hurting sales of tickets.
Well, in 90 minutes, American found that some of the biggest waits were 90 minutes. These are for domestic flights. That seems kind of high. I mean, why did they let so many people go? Why would they do that before they knew what this pre-screen thing was going to be?
Yeah, I think there you have your government in action, right?
Right.
So they were trying, I think, to do the right thing, which was to cut back. And they do have over 45,000 screeners. It's not like they have a small number of screeners. And one of the problems is that the PreCheck program, they really haven't promoted it. It had a lot of initial sign-up. They were dragging people randomly out of the normal line. Now, you with PreCheck, you basically go through pre-9/11 style. That's a metal detector, liquids in your bags, your laptop, your shoes on when you go through, completely different, can screen you twice as fast. But a couple of incidences where at least one convicted domestic terrorist actually made it into the PreCheck line. They also had some people actually trying to test the system by taking in things, and they didn't score very well. I think it was a 9 out of 100. They actually scored on the test, so they actually had a pretty bad failure there. So they had to roll back that program of pulling people out for PreCheck. And, you know, PreCheck, to me, along with Global Entry, which is actually better, which includes PreCheck, which also lets you skip through the immigration and customs lines when you get back. If you fly internationally, it's way better. It doesn't take more than a few minutes to actually sign up and fill in the forms. I just don't think that people really understand what it's all about.
And, you know, you're the expert here, but is it because people, I mean, are we seeing people who don't normally fly a lot think, you know, I'm not a frequent flyer, why should I sign up for that?
And that's true, yeah. If you're only flying once a year, it's probably overkill to spend the $80 to do that. It just doesn't make any sense for you. If you're flying more than two or more times a year, it actually makes sense. You know, I signed up at the time, my 8-year-old daughter, 4.5 years ago for Global Entry. We travel, you know, internationally a couple times a year as a family, and I do it many times. So I agree that it's a lot of business travelers actually signed up for it very quickly. The problem is they can't get the normal traveling public to sign up for something like that.
And, you know, here's what I would do. Here's what is going through my head right now. That is, you know, they're nickel and diming me already with all these fees. I'm not going to pay another fee. Maybe the airline should cut people some slack and give them a credit if they sign up for this.
Yeah, in fact, in many cases, not only, I think I agree with airlines doing it, also credit card companies are doing it as part of their credit card program. I know several of them will reimburse any type of fee, including bag fees or TSA fees, up to $200. So it has. There are programs out there to basically give back some of that money. You just got to get more people to sign up.
So we're headed into the summer travel season. We have this problem. We also have the threat of possible terrorism.
It really is a perfect storm.
It is sort of a perfect storm. We do see a little, the ticket prices to Europe dropping slightly. That means demand is depressed. There are some people that clearly are worried about that. So we've seen some of those prices come down slightly. Not a huge amount to places like London, Paris, and Rome, which are the three most popular destinations. So, but other locations, it's a little bit softer than we saw it about a month and a half ago. So, you know, they're trying to spur on some demand. The dollar is extremely strong in Europe. It's a huge incentive for Americans to go over because all their activities, everything they do there, dining, a lot of people are taking empty bags to Europe and coming back with full bags just because it's so cheap in Europe right now.
We talked before here on the opening bell with you about this, about the Olympics in Brazil, and the last time we spoke it was a little too early to get a figure, but the Olympic Committee and the folks in Brazil this week have announced that ticket sales are going badly internationally and domestically there. Are people buying plane tickets yet to go to Brazil?
It's going a lot worse than they expected, and the ticket prices have dropped dramatically over the last month and a half or so. This is a perfect time to start shopping for them. Those people that did wait and want to go down there, they definitely can find some better deals. They put on some capacity as well, which also, you know, with increased capacity and a little drop in demands has dropped the prices as well. I think part of it is it's a very lengthy trip, especially from people in the U.S. or people coming in from Europe, which would be the people that a lot of them would frequent that. They don't have a huge amount of interest from Latin America countries flying in there. And so I think they've sort of overcooked how many people they thought they were going to get down there.
So get us out of town for the weekend or a small trip. Where are the good fares?
Well, right now, as I've mentioned before, Dallas, where I'm in, Chicago, where you guys are, is one of the cheapest cities to fly out of right now. And I was looking on all the three major legacy airlines and also Spirit Airlines, crazy low prices around the country. But places like Vancouver, under $300 round trip, that's in the late May, early June, excellent pricing. Seattle, under $200. You also have Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, all under $200 round trip. If you want to head down to South Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, under $200 round trip. And even out to the East Coast, typically prices would be in the low 200s, now in the low, sort of right around 150 to 160, Boston, New York, right at 155.
You know, I've done the Vancouver trip. That's a wonderful time of that's a good trip, and this, that's the perfect time to go to Vancouver.
Late spring in Vancouver is awesome.
Yeah, it is. Rick, thank you very much. Happy flying, safe travels as always.
You too. Take care.
Rick Cini is the founder of faircompare.com. You can find him on Twitter at Rick Cini and at faircompare.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:49. Welcome back to the Opening Bell. Dow futures pointing higher this morning toward the opening bell, and 77 points up this hour. The S&P NASDAQ futures also higher, also just in to the WGN newsroom, to the business desk. Markets, this is earnings season, and JP Morgan Chase has just reported Q1 earnings. It looks like up about, still looking at some of the data here. It looks like it's up just a little bit. We're still getting some more information in, but it looks like JP Morgan Chase is up just a little bit, 135 versus 126. So yeah, it's up. We'll have that throughout the morning. Right now, let's get the latest on commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. Yesterday, corn futures notched their biggest daily gain so far in 2016. Bull spreading in the market and short covering as other commodities like crude oil also rose sharply. And the higher prices in corn came despite USDA monthly data released at midday predicting larger U.S. ending stocks due to reduced demand for feed and for food, and as extended weather outlooks were seen as favorable for U.S. planting. And Brazil's agriculture ministry said it will ask to suspend the 10% tariff on imports of corn from origins such as the United States. So for the day, corn showed a 6.5 cent gain on the nearby May contract, and it closed at 362 3/4, and new crop December corn ended up 5 1/4. That's your money. Have a good day. Hey. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You too. If you're thinking about refinancing your home, maybe pulling out a little money for home equity, beware. Terry Savage is with us this morning on the Opening Bell. Terry, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, we saw these, we keep seeing these low interest rates, and people might be tempted to do home equity, but you have a warning for them.
I do indeed. In a most recent column, we're seeing low interest rates. That's been very good for the stock market. And by the way, the J.P. Morgan Chase earnings this morning were about 9 cents stronger than expected. So that should set the tone for another very good morning in the stock market. But what's happening is the banks are having trouble making money. That's why it's so good that J.P. Morgan Chase made more money than expected. So what they are doing now is going back to what got them eventually and all of us in trouble almost a decade ago. They're going out and sending out messages. You know, you can get a home equity line of credit. And then, of course, once you get that line of credit, you're tempted to use it and take money out of your home. Recent Wall Street Journal big article said that in last year, lenders extended $156 billion in home equity lines of credit. That was the largest amount since the housing bust in 2007. The average amount of the lines of credit was $119,790.
Oh.
So it's like a credit card. You're tempted to use it because you want to remodel, you're finally above water, and you have some equity in your home. It could be very dangerous. I'll give you two quick points. The low interest rates make the payments low if you take down the line of credit, but only because when most home equity loans, you're only paying the interest, not any principal. So 10 years from now, it's like a bubble that will burst. You don't know that rates will be that low then, and you'll have to refinance the whole loan. So a home equity line of credit, or using it as actually as a home equity loan, is very, very dangerous.
Do you sometimes, Terry, feel like you want to reach through the radio and shake people and say, what are you thinking? Because we don't, we hear all the time that consumers since 2008 have been smarter, they've been paying off their bills, they've been saving money. You're saying not so much when it comes to home equity loans. Don't you just want to shake people?
I do, because I kept writing 10, 12, 15 years ago about Dan Marino with the Miami quarterback standing in the kitchen. Take out money for your home equity loan and remodel your kitchen and go on a vacation. Hey, listen, if your house gets foreclosed, that vacation memory fades pretty quickly. And it seems like our memories of doing the responsible thing fade. So it's just a warning sign I wanted to set out. The banks are all excited they're making money because they found, you know, they can't make very much money on most loans.
Yeah.
Rates are so low. I just don't want them to come back at all of us and say, yeah, great, rates are low. On the other hand, I should say that we are now at the lowest mortgage rate level of all. So if you haven't refinanced yet, most people have, do it. But lock in that low rate for 15 years. Or even 30 years if you think you'll be around. Even if you're not going to be having the home in 30 years, you don't have any risk if you lock in the low rates for 30 years.
Yeah, if you do this other thing, you know, in the words of the late Chris Farley, you're going to be living in a van down by the river.
We had the graphic demonstration of it.
Yeah.
So home equity loans, rates float. From here, they can only float upward. You're only paying interest. Don't do it.
Yeah, but the banks, too, don't they have a little bit in this? I mean, you'd think that after 2008 that all of these practices would stop, but they really haven't, have they?
Well, banks take a risk when they make loans. They didn't weigh the risks very carefully. And, by the way, they sold those loans and passed them on. They never thought, like Goldman Sachs, that they'd wind up paying a $5 billion fine for packaging a lot of bad loans with the good ones. So they are being much more careful. But if a bank has a pool of loans and spreads it over 350 loans, they can afford to write off one loss. But if it's your home that they're writing off, you have a very personal risk.
Yeah.
So I just don't want people to go out there and put their home, the roof over your head.
Terry Savage is
not a piggy bank.
Terry Savage is looking out for you, folks, at Terry Talks Money. Terry, thanks for being with us in the opening bell and giving us a good warning this morning.
Always glad to be with you. It's going to be a good day, Steve.
Great. Thank you very much. It's 5:56. Again, Terry Talks Money at Twitter. You can also find her online as well, and she's a regular guest here on WGN. That's the opening bell for today. The Steve Cochran Show is coming up next. We'll, of course, be following all of these stories throughout the morning. We'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning for another edition of the opening bell at 5 o'clock. Our producer is Mary Sandberg. Production help from Bennett Wakenight. Our engineer is Ben Cortez. Again, Steve Cochran next. Have a great day. It's 5:57.